Hello, and welcome to People Profit Planet. My name's Christina Anderson, and I am the Communications and Marketing Coordinator for the Office of Sustainability.
And I'm Alejandro Galeana Salinas, and I am the Graphic Design and Web Development Coordinator for the Office of Sustainability.
Mm-hmm. And today we have a special guest, which is...
My name is Nick Mullins. I'm a former fourth-generation coal miner from southwestern Virginia. Not West Virginia, but southwestern Virginia. Mm-hmm. And senior, and communications major.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So today, we're just going to talk a little bit about some of Nick's experiences. He took us on a mountaintop removal tour, which was really, really awesome. But we're just going to talk a little bit about what he's been doing with sustainability and his reasoning behind that. But before we get to that, we just want to give you a couple updates. The Dandelion Festival went really, really, really well. It was so much fun. Hopefully, we can't wait to see what it's going to expand to be next year. Let's see.
We had over 500 guests, uh-huh, for a fact. Probably like coming and going, of course, like rotating. We had a bunch of live bands and, mm-hmm, my booth, which was a face painting booth. It was really popular. It was really awesome. Mm-hmm. So we want to see that keep going every year.
Yeah, for sure. Also, last night we had our award dinner for Fairchild for the Eco Challenge. We had the recycling team and Fairchild and some people from the CDL come down. So that was really, really cool. Also this week, I believe Thursday or Friday, we're going to have the ceremonial like tree planting for the carbon neutral basketball game.
Friday morning at 9:30 in front, okay, of or behind Kentucky Talcott, yeah, lawn. So if you want to come by.
Yeah. It's going to be really cool. We're going to have isn't the mayor going to be there?
The mayor will be there.
The mayor's going to be there, as well as the president. So, well, not the president, but, like, you know, the president of the college.
The president of the United States will come.
So, Mr. Ruloff should be there. We're also going to have, this week is also, we're having a duck challenge. So, a duck recycling, it's like... We have ducks, green ducks with recycling symbols on them, hidden all around campus. So, you guys, if you find them, they're going to be at different sustainable locations on campus. So, make sure to be on the lookout for those. Those are going to be at different sustainable places on campus. And if you find them and you turn them into IMC, which is behind, like, Papalino's, the person who's turned in the most is going to win a free t-shirt. So that would be cool. So,
cool. Yeah.
But I think that's pretty much all we have going on. You guys can make it through the rest of the semester. We only have a couple more weeks left and a couple more shows. So
yeah, this is the last full week of classes. And next week, got reading period on Friday. So it's coming to a close.
Definitely. So, Nick, I saw your article. I read your article that was in, what was that?
The Berea Alumnus Magazine or the Yes Magazine?
The Yes Magazine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That one was really cool. So if you just want to, like, introduce yourself and, like, what you've done, that would be really, really cool.
Okay. Well, how much time do we have?
We have a 30-minute time slot.
Nice. So. Well, they only gave me 650 words to put all, a lot of history and life into one article.
Definitely.
But, I still appreciate that they gave me the opportunity. My name is Nick Mullins. I'm originally from Clintwood, Virginia. That's about 3.5 hours here, but just across the border from Kentucky into Virginia. Like I said earlier, I was the fourth generation of my family to work in the underground coal mines. Fifth, if you count my second great-grandfather, he did a little bit of work in the mines on and off in between moonshining. My life was pretty much centered around coal for many years. Having seen my dad work in the mines, both my grandfathers, my great-grandfather passed away whenever I was about 6 years old from black lung. We was also very much a union family. During 1989, there was a strike against Pittston Coal, and I learned, that the coal companies weren't there for the people. Mm-hmm. So, but, I eventually, I was always told never to go into the mines, and it just wasn't a good life, even with the good pay and union benefits that had existed. And I don't know, I stayed out of the mines 10 years after I graduated high school, but eventually decided that the money and benefits were might be worth my while, especially having a, you know, having my wife Rusty and her two kids, Daniel and Alex, to support. So,
for sure, that's a lot to take on for, you know, it becomes a necessity almost.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really liked the ending quote that you ended your Yes Magazine article with. That we learned that we could live without coal, and I think that's something that you not just like individual families that are impacted by the coal industry, but just the United States in general. Like, we have all of these other sustainable resources that we can use to live without coal, and it's such a harmful industry towards so many people that it's just the benefits of, you know, you can learn to live without it, and it's something that we can totally do. It's just not, you know, enough backing for it.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And that's, you know, that's where I've, you know, the point that I've come to. You know, I worked about 4 years for the industry. Three of those were, you know, pretty much underground as an electrician. Well, first roof boulder operator and shuttle car operator. But the whole reason I was there was to make more money, because I had this belief that if you make more money and you can afford the things that you want, then you'll be happier in life.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing further from the truth. I mean, there's definitely things that money can make easier. But whenever you're having to sacrifice so much for it, and it wasn't an eye-opening experience until, or, you know, we didn't really wake up to it until we lost our house in a fire, and we lost everything that we'd ever owned and worked towards, and even what my great-grandfather had worked towards, because it was, we'd inherited his house and had fixed it up. So it was just kind of one of those surrealistic moments in your life where you have to rethink things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did, and we began to realize we don't have to have all this stuff to make us happy. You know, we've gotten too far away from the basics of life and what it is to be human and have a community and to find happiness in things that aren't material and aren't completely and entirely comfortable all the time, all year long.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think that's, you know, part of the reason why, you know, that's where a lot of our problems are. You know, we're such a consumeristic society that, you know, we're just consuming more and more and more, and that's where a lot of the problems come in with, you know, to get all of these things, you know, you have to have energy to make the things, which, you know, comes from usually coal, and then you have to have stuff to transport it, which is more, you know, natural resources being expended, and it's just, you know, such a wasteful thing. I really do believe that more people need to appreciate experiences and that sort of thing instead of buying more and more and more to be happy.
Yeah.
So,
well, sure. I mean, at the, you know, at the pinnacle of where I was making money, the last full year that I worked in the mines as an electrician, I was making $28.75 an hour and working on average 10 hours of overtime a week.
Oh, gosh.
So... that year, I brought home I had a gross paycheck, or I grossed $72,000. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, there's PhDs out there that that would like to earn that kind of money, but it's at the same time, I was you know, looking back at it, I didn't realize how miserable I was. You know, every now and then, I mean, I was always tired, I was always fatigued, and the height of my enjoyment was kicking back on the couch with a bag of Lay's potato chips and watching Deadliest Catch. You know, but I didn't have time to really do anything else, and whenever it came time to play with the kids, I was either worn out or I had a short temper and they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, and I was expecting a lot more of them. It was just looking back, I was a horrible father and a horrible person, and it just wasn't worth it. But I had it better than some, maybe some guys that were making, that were working 90 hours plus a week.
Oh, gosh. So,
but, and for the same purposes, they had big houses, multiple vehicles, you know, close to $3,000 a month just in car payments and mortgages. So it really, and then whenever you, like you say, you put that in terms of energy, in materials and embodied energy that it takes to manufacture all that and keep those houses mm-hmm. warm and burn the fuel to run those vehicles. It's, I think the current, you know, the percentages range, but I think right now we have the United States constitutes 4.4% of the world population. It means, you know, out of, mm-hmm. you know, what are we at, 7 billion people now? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Americans make up 4.4% of that. And yet we use 18% of that energy in direct energy use, of mm-hmm. the world's total energy is used by Americans in direct use. That doesn't include the energy that it takes to manufacture the goods mm-hmm. and extract the resources in China,
yeah.
in Bangladesh, in all these foreign countries. And, you know, there's some figures that say that we use 30% of world resources, not just including energy. So mm-hmm. our lifestyles and this belief that we have to buy all these things and have all this money and live this way is just not sustainable. And mm-hmm. it's horrible for the people who have to deal with it in the extraction and production of things.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. We went on, you took us on a mountaintop removal tour at the beginning of this, the beginning of last semester, so the beginning of, last year. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very impactful. I came from western Kentucky, so, you know, very, very flat. And they are doing mining out there, actually, but I never really, it was the first time I had been in, like, all these huge mountains and trees, and it was so beautiful, and I was like, oh, this is nature. But then you realize, like, what the coal industry and stuff is doing in places like that. And it's, like, it's just so terrible. And to hear that, like, your family has built, like, the negative environmental impacts as well, like the slurries and the contamination of water and that kind of stuff. I saw something on Facebook. I don't remember quite where it was, but it was like a copper, slurry or something like mm-hmm. broke, and it contaminated like all this water. I think it was like off the coast of like Brazil mm. or South America, and it like is going out into like the ocean,
yeah.
and it's like this huge, huge environmental disaster. And I mean, people don't realize that, you know, that's happening in America yeah. as well. So, what was it like to, you know, see that one day, you know, your backyard was basically like terrible?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you grow up in it and, you know, you see strip mining and things, uh-huh. like I remember, I think I was maybe in third grade whenever they came in and did a contour strip mine across the valley from us or across the holler. Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between a contour mine and on a surface mine and a mountaintop removal is on a contour, they kind of etch a bench out along the mm-hmm. side of the mountain. They just kind of take a L cut out so that they can get to the seam that lays horizontally in the mountain and drill it out. And they'll use huge augers to drill the coal out, and then they can just push the, you know, it leaves a big high wall, and now they have to push dirt back up against that high wall and reform the contour of the mountain. Mm-hmm. With mountaintop removal, they just take the top of the mountain off all the way down to the coal seam and scrape it up, mm-hmm. and they dispose of all the excess mountaintop into a valley. They just dump it into a valley called a valley fill. But whenever I was growing up, they did a contour job across the holler, and, you know, it was exciting to see the explosions. You
True.
Know, we were watching yeah. A-Team and G.I. Joe, and
yeah,
if that dates me any. But, you know, and it was exciting,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we didn't understand.
True.
We just understood that that's where people worked, and that they were pushing dirt around. We thought it was no worse than us playing with our Tonka toys in the yard.
Yeah.
And then whenever they decided, I was older, I think I was about 18 or 19, whenever they came in and said that they were going to mountaintop remove behind the house. Mm-hmm. And that was the mountain that, you know, was pretty much whole. We got our mushrooms off of it. That was where our spring was, and that's where me and my cousin had spent all our life. And we really didn't want to see it because even though they did put the mountain back pretty good in most places, it was still really destructive. It was taking mm-hmm. out the forests. And this one place, this big boulder that was on top of the mountain that we called Indian Rock, it was just kind of a monolith. It was about 10 feet high and about 10 feet in diameter, flattened on the top with moss on it. And a small alcove that somebody had actually built a fire underneath part of it, and we thought it was Native Americans. It ended up being our great uncles who had played hooky from school whenever they were kids. But still, you know, I just, we played on that thing, and it was going to be gone forever, as long as it had been there, and that bothered me. But we didn't own that land that was on the other side of the mountain, so we couldn't do anything about it, and you just have to accept it and go on. Plus, some of the family members that did have parts of their land, they were being promised money and royalties from the coal industry for how much coal that they would get off of it. And some of them really needed it because they had some medical expenses from having worked in the mines and, you know, become injured and disabled. So you just deal with it. But, you know, I don't know, after I left the mines and I was fed up with the way that they had treated us and how the union wasn't there to help us out anymore like they used to be, I reached out to the environmentalists, and, you know, I kind of started learning more and more about mountaintop removal. That's why I went deep mine, and I didn't go underground, or I went underground, I didn't go surface, because I couldn't stand that. But still, yeah, it was just, you start to wake up, and then you realize what's been lost.
For sure. Yeah, I understand, like, it's not nearly to the same extent, but as a kid, there was, I mean, Owensboro is right across, like, the river. It's on a river front. So there's a big, we have a big coal plant there. And there's a lot of also, like, other energy things going on. I'm not quite sure of all the what's going on, but there was this big factory as a kid, and, you know, you look at it and you think, like, oh, you know, like, these clouds, it's like a cloud machine almost. And, like, my grandpa, whenever we would drive past it, he would, like, he called it Old Smoky, and he would, you know, make it talk and stuff like that. That was his big thing. He would make things talk to me. And it was, you know, it kind of gave personality to this thing that, as I got older, I was like, that's actually really ugly. That's actually terrible for the environment. And I'm, like, right here next to it. And I never realized that. So, for sure.
It takes, you know, it takes a little bit to understand it. And it takes some age. And for some people, they never understand. Just the, you know, their impacts, or they find ways to justify it or to diminish the impacts. You know, it's like coal ash. Well, that's ash. You know, there can't be anything wrong with that. It's it's like ashes I get out of my stove, and I can rub those all over my body, and it's no problem. But, you know, so people make these connections and liking things. But, and it's out of sight, out of mind, too. I mean, that's the reason that I wanted to, I've been doing these mountaintop removal tours ever since I've been here at Berea and had the opportunity to, you know, because I wanted you all to be able to see, you know, something that isn't normally shown unless you go looking for it. You know?
Like, I had no idea, because I come from Athens, Georgia, which is, you know, a city, and, like, flat Georgia. So, like, there's, like, no mountains around us. We have Stone Mountain, which is a giant rock in Atlanta. Like, that's literally what that is. So we don't do that, you know. We don't get to see any of that, and I just never, ever, ever saw the connection between, like, how we got our energy, you know, how we got our energy. Pretty much all I knew of it was, you know, the power. What is it? The power companies. That's where we got our energy, but it didn't go past that, you know. So it was really good to see that. You know, I didn't get it until, like, months after, or, you know, like, some time passed, and it was like fermenting, and I was, like, connecting, you know, like, the exploit of the exploitation of people, you know, in a community. I get that, you know, being Mexican in the United States, an immigrant to the United States, I get that, you know, the exploitation of people's lands, I get that, you know, because, like I say, like, I come from Mexico, and you see a lot of that stuff happening as well to, like, indigenous lands in Mexico. So, like, after, you know, making these connections, I started, you know, like, realizing just how bad the situation was, you know. And, I mean, like this whole year has been transformative, I think, like, just being at Berea. Because, like, this is something that I didn't have any idea, had no clue.
We're only freshmen, but I've, like, learned so much from, like, this first year. I've just been exposed to so many different things, and, like, I've learned so much, and I feel like I'm a completely different person than I was, you know, coming here. Like, I know so much more, so,
And we need to multiply that, because, you know, whenever you get right down to it, in a global economy, everything mm-hmm. that we're using, everything that we're consuming is causing damage elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it gets really depressing. And if you're not careful, I mean, one of the things that, as I've gone through my time here at Berea mm-hmm. and just prior to Berea, is I've gone from this phase of just realizing how much is destroyed and how much we are destroying with everything that we're doing in our lives mm-hmm. and becoming extremely depressed about it to, and I mean, I've had some pretty good bouts with depression to, you know, eventually kind of coming to terms with it and understanding that, you know, we have to find a way to work and keep pushing mm-hmm. and find hope to fix it. But, you know, everything that we do and how much is just consumed. I did some figures. In 2013, the Energy Information Administration, U.S. Energy Information Administration, said that the world consumed 8.7 billion tons of coal. Now, mm-hmm. you know, 8.7, that doesn't sound like a big number, even if you throw the billion onto the end of it. But let's put it into a visual. It would be a coal train with 53-foot trailer or coal gons at 110 tons each. It would take a coal train that wrapped the Earth 29 times around the equator to hold that much coal.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Now, imagine you're standing at the equator, and you're standing on top of a train car, and you look across, and there's 29 more, and each one of them is going around the entire globe, over 24,000 miles,
yeah.
if I'm not mistaken. I hope my astronomy professor isn't listening. And then, you know, burn that. Put that into the atmosphere. And as Dr. Olson, Richard Olson, said, whenever I gave him that figure, he says, "And Nick, how much oil do you think that it would take to move that train? Because that coal had to be moved."
Yeah.
From the time that it was extracted to the time that it ended up wherever it was ending up, whether it be for manufacturing steel, to build bridges and skyscrapers, or it was being burned for energy, which is where the majority of it goes. Mm-hmm. So, everything that we do, you know, even if it doesn't matter if it's energy or metal or food, we're consuming and we're participants in this destruction of ecosystems that we still rely on, that we came from. And it's kind of philosophical when people want to shut you off, but
we've
got to be realizing this. Mm-hmm. We have to be letting other people know and getting people to understand transition and reduce. That's why I'm so much about reducing, you know, not so much about the recycling.
Mm-hmm. Start at the source, pretty much.
Yep.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. There's mm-hmm. actually 4 R's now, or 5, but I know it's, I think the 5 R's is refuse. Refuse the things that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to refuse that kind of consumerist, materialistic culture. Reduce what you need. Let's see. And then it is repair, and then recycle. And I know I'm missing one out of there.
Reuse,
mm-hmm. yes. Reduce, reuse, repair, recycle, which repair and reduce or reuse are kind of similar. Mm-hmm. But you know, recycle is at the bottom. And that's the last thing that we should be focusing on. That's after mm-hmm. every other thing has been addressed first.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what I'd like to see more and more people doing and educated to do.
Definitely, yeah. I don't know. I see, like, so much, like just so much mass consumption. Like, even here at Berea College, like, the salad containers that we get. Like, I want to eat healthy, but at the same time, it's like, this is a thick, like, reusable plastic. Like, I cannot imagine, like, the resources that went into, like, making that. And then, like, of course I'm going to, like, recycle it. But at the same time, it just feels like that's not enough,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's like, of course, like, I feel like that is one of the first steps, I guess. Because, I mean, there's so many things that people are focusing on. And, yes, like, you have to understand, like, oh, you know, I need to do something good with this. But at the same time, it's like, how do we backtrack a little bit more and, like, get this better, like, in a different, like, instead of using these over and over. Because I have, like, 5 now, and I'm like, I can't do anything with these.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Whenever, I'm getting, you know, I'm having to buy stuff that's got excess packaging, I'm constantly aware.
Yeah.
You know, and I beat myself up over it. I can't go to malls anymore. Rusty will not let me go to a mall because I go there and I get what I call third world vision. You know, I'll walk into a Hollister or something. I'll pick up a pair of $70 trousers, and I'll look, and it's made in Bangladesh. And I know that the hands that made that garment, you know, were likely that of a child or somebody who's making less than a dollar a day or maybe just a couple of dollars a day. And yet, here, $70 a pair, you know, it's ridiculous. But at the same time, we can't beat people up.
Yeah,
I just think that... You know, I mean, I use a laptop. I exist in this culture. Right now, we're underneath lights in the studio that are coming from 92% of it's generated by coal. Everything that's going on in here is, you know, there's conflict metals in the electronics that come from the Congo, and kids having to mine that, and women who are abused and raped and exploited. The choice comes in knowing that you're using these things, and then how are you using them? Is it just to play video games? Is it just to benefit yourself and your beliefs and what you want? Or is it working to help fix and give people what they need? And that's where we, you know, if you really want to get into it, you can think about how much money this college gets and where it comes from. You know, I mean, it's from the stock market, and it's from donors who make a lot more money than we do. And how do they make that money? And it's all tied to the same global economy, that same resource extraction, that same energy use, that same petrochemical industry that manufactures you name it. It's all tied, and it's scary.
You said that to me last semester, you know, that when we were working in the office, you said, you know, I recognize all of these terrible things that have gone into me making this, but I'm going to use it for a good purpose. And I feel like that's one of the biggest takeaways, because... you mentioned something earlier about getting, like, very, like, hung up on stuff, and, like, it can just get you down when you realize that everything is, like, terrible, and it's, like, I feel like we need, like, an activist, like, support group or something. I feel like that has to be a thing. It's just, like, everything, you know, it just gets so overwhelming to see, like, all this terrible things, but, you know, you have to realize that you're doing something good with it, and, you know, with this college education, you can't, you know, it's... with the money that's, you know, coming from these sources, I'm going to use it for, you know, my experience for something good. So I think that's what we have to take away from it.
It's finding that balance. It's being willing to push really hard and go beyond the norms. And sometimes that comes with personal sacrifices and, you know, social connections and friendships and working relationships. You'll lose those. But, you know, that's some of the sacrifices that we have to make. And we have to find that line and not cross it, because whenever you do, it does get, you know, it can get overwhelming and very depressing. And you mentioned that, you know, activist support groups. Well, there's actually now professional psychologists who focus in on environmental activists or people in social justice movements.
That's important. Well, I'm glad we're talking about that, because I was just talking to one of my friends. I'm going to name drop, I guess. Her name is Sarah Mirza. She's a really cool activist as well back home. And we were just talking about, like, how much of our exhaustion, you know, when it comes to, like, our own, like, mental exhaustion that comes from activism. And, you know, like you said, like, realizing that even though we're fighting for some things, like, you know, like, sometimes the guilt of knowing that, you know, you're also... you're also participating in these systems of oppression, you know, whether one way or another, you know, it can get to you. And so it's essentially, you know, like we were talking about, like, how regular psychologists just can't, you know, they can't fix that because they're taught to, you know, to give you, like, coping mechanisms, essentially. You know, they're taught to tell you, oh, you know, just think positively, or they're taught to, to not look, you know, like, you're being affected by the environment around you and not so much by the actions of people. So that's very much different than, like, then there's a very much different focus. So I'm glad you're saying that there's, like, activist therapists now, because that's definitely a different brand of therapy that's needed.
Yeah, that definitely has to be a thing.
Yeah.
But we are running very close to time. So,
care if I throw one more thing
out there? Go ahead.
And just real quickly, whenever it comes to terms to actually getting things done and working towards fixing these problems. I think it's necessary to realize that we have to look at what has worked and what hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. And that's somewhere that I get really deep into, is that, you know, I don't believe that traditional activism, you know, and protesting and things can all, it's necessary in some cases, but yeah. we have to really look at the way that we communicate and who we're talking to and our audience and find the best ways to communicate them. Throwing oil on people and, you know, or just having huge blow-up turtles and telling everybody that the polar bears are dying is not going to get blue-collar people who are struggling day-to-day to, to really give a care about it. You have to meet them on their level, and sometimes that means talking about ways to save money on your energy bill.
Yeah.
It's watered down, but, hey, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I totally get that. Yeah. Absolutely. It takes a lot of different techniques to get progress going, essentially. We call it, well, back home at least, we call it the grassroots versus the suits, pretty much. And sometimes you have to be a little bit of both.
And, of course, the other option is just to bring the system down.
That's always the option.
Which I hope you're listening in, Jerry. I think it's your shift at the NSA. How's your kids doing today?
Yeah, definitely. I think that ties in really well with, like, I guess, like, my major. Like, one thing my grandmother has always told me is, like, know your audience and know, like, what your problem or what you're trying to do, where it hits them. And in some ways that can be, you know, very corrupted if you use it for negative reasons. But if you use it for, like, good things, like, my major is sociology and communication, so I feel like I can... Yes. get those together very, very well. And
that's why I'm a comm major.
Yeah, for sure.
That's and I encourage everybody to take communications at least 100 or interpersonal, and take SENS courses, people.
Definitely.
We need people taking SENS courses here.
Yes.
Sustainability and Environmental Studies. All right, I'll be quiet now.
Yeah, definitely. But I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for being on the show, Nick.
Thank you.
Yeah, do you have any last words, Alejandro?
No, that was perfect. That was a perfect episode. No music. We didn't need any music, so that was really cool.
Didn't need any music, for sure.
Hope they enjoy that.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you guys next week for our very last show. Thanks.
All right. Of the semester.
Of the semester.
Of the semester. Well, not our very last show, of the semester. Okay, bye, guys.
Bye-bye.